Welcome to TechLash, a celebration and dissection of the tech industry and its impact on the world. Warning, this podcast has been known to raise awareness, provoke thought, and spark debate. The views expressed by the host do not reflect those of the guests, sponsors, or any other competing interests.
There is a major breakthrough heading to American
history. Twitter has an iPhone.
Researchers at MIT are hailing a breakthrough in the field of artificial intelligence.
Just how crucial is diversity to the tech world's future?
Different economic backgrounds, different educational backgrounds.
Welcome to TechLash. I'm Zibi Nwaka, and I'm here with Theo Miller. Theo, who are we speaking with today?
Today, we've got a super exciting episode. We got Dion Nicholas, the co-founder and CEO of Forethought.
Awesome. And what does Forethought do?
Forethought wants to make everyone a genius at their job, which basically means they have an AI named Agatha that allows people who use the Forethought software to access information in ways they couldn't before. So when I first came across it, I thought it was a lot like an intercom chatbot because people use the words artificial intelligence and AI very casually, very liberally. But once you dig into it, you realize how sophisticated it actually is. Then you realize they're a TechCrunch Disrupt winner from 2018. And the more you get into their story, you realize, oh, they are like pre-unicorn status.
And why should someone listen to the episode today?
That's pretty easy to answer. If you've ever cared about science fiction or ever been into AGI, which is this whole concept of artificial general intelligence, and broadly what that is as opposed to solving low-level tasks, artificial intelligence eventually will be able to do the whole thing where it's mistakable for a human being, the whole Turing test thing. That's AGI. And there's different people in tech who are starting to emerge as zealots for AGI is just around the corner versus AGI is never going to happen. But then there's also this other piece, which is unconscious bias in AI, which I find also super fascinating because I think of it as the consciousness we have today. You really do not want to build the architecture of artificial intelligence around that consciousness because it could get perpetuated into the 22nd, 23rd, 24th century.
Yeah, that's right. Excited to jump into this episode today. But first, a word from our sponsor. Diversity has always been an issue in tech, and now it has been compounded with a worldwide pandemic that disproportionately impacts underrepresented groups. This needs to change. FlockJ is a tech sales training academy that helps job seekers from non-traditional backgrounds break into tech. Through 300 plus hours of live instruction, real sales practice, and one-on-one coaching, students master the art and science of tech sales. Top tech companies like Zoom, Gusto, and Airtable partner with FlockJ to hire diverse, elite SDRs that ramp faster and outperform ordinary reps. Visit flockj.com to learn more. That's FlockJay.com.
When you're on a truly exponential curve, it starts off flat, and then eventually you're like, wait, dude, this is like the future, right? And so that's how I think about artificial intelligence as well. And obviously, I love to work on the problems like natural language understanding. How do you teach an AI to truly understand a question and then answer it? How do you teach an AI to do logical inference? Like John picked up the ball, John walked over to the table, John put down the ball. Well, where is the ball? There's nothing in that sentence that says that the ball is on the table, but that's the answer to that. A human could figure that out. How do we get a machine to figure that out using logic?
Artificial intelligence is one of these technologies like virtual reality, where when I was a kid, there was something called a Virtual Boy, which was Nintendo's solution for virtual reality, as though virtual reality was going to happen in 1990 before we even had iPads. And even with iPads, Apple had this tablet called the Newton back then. So these massive technologies go through all these different iterations. And so it's happened with tablets, it's happened with virtual reality, and it's really happening with artificial intelligence. But what's cool about this period in particular, Zib, is the fact that in 2017, there's about $27 billion spent on artificial intelligence. That's the market size of it. And by 2027, it's going to be like $270 billion.
Yeah, I used to get Popular Science magazine subscription gifted to me when I was younger, and I loved science fiction. You mentioned VR, and the first version of VR for me was the 3D glasses that you
put on as a child is like, wow, this is unbelievable. But the stuff that they're doing now is absolutely incredible. I think when we talk about artificial intelligence, there's a few definitions that we should share with listeners. And so when people think of artificial intelligence, a lot of times they're talking about artificial general intelligence, which is an AI can basically think and learn like a human. And we are still quite a ways away from artificial general intelligence. A lot of what we see is artificial narrow intelligence, which is being able to automate these menial tasks, and a machine can learn and then repeat tasks that it's fed. And so I want to just make sure that we set up those definitions and understand where we're at in the world of artificial intelligence.
Let's say you take the simplest 30, 40, 50% of tickets, that can all get handled by Agatha. And then as a customer support agent, one of their biggest concerns and one of their biggest interests is how can I continue to level up in my job? And so this means they get to focus on the really interesting questions, the problems where they get to demonstrate empathy. It's not just looking something up in a menial task, but they get to flex their problem solving abilities and things like that. And so everyone wins when you have artificial intelligence able to handle the simple and then help you as a human with the complex.
I love that constructive perspective. There's so much concern around what's going to happen with jobs, with automation, but it's been proven through history time and time again. When we transition from an agrarian society to an industrial society, a ton of jobs were lost. But over time, we realized there were functions we could not even conceive of that did not exist. An elevator operator was not something that existed in an agrarian economy, but it did over time. And in the 21st century, there's going to be jobs brought on by the information age. It just feels like a severe lack of imagination that's leading us to this level of skepticism about the future.
Yeah. I agree. There will be job disruption, but I think many new jobs are going to be created as well from the advancement of artificial intelligence. And right now in this moment, a lot of these tools are helping people become superpowered at their jobs. And I've worked as a customer service agent, so I know what that's like. And if you're working with enterprise clients and it's high stress, high pressure, I've worked as a customer support rep for software that supported law firms and paralegals, and they're under a lot of stress. And being able to answer and solve problems quickly, if you can reduce that time by 10 minutes, 15 minutes across a whole group of support reps, let's say then you can get that reduction in time. Now you can start responding to these questions even faster, giving a level of customer service that folks probably aren't going to experience with other products and industries, giving your company a significant competitive advantage. And so you're going to deliver service that could beat your competitors quite easily.
To put a really fine point on it, Forethought has different versions of Agatha, right? So there's a version of Agatha that just responds to low-level questions, but then there's another version of Agatha that does deep research in the knowledge base based on all the former support requests, based on knowledge docs. It pulls up all the information that's needed to answer the questions so that the rep can look at that and they don't have to go digging around and being like, oh, how is the data model structured? What are the permissions? And from my background in designing enterprise software, it's impossible to state how valuable that is because through so many iterations of the product, permissions are always changing. These are not rewarding tasks, but they have to be done. And this is going to allow people to solve higher level problems, which will eventually expand job opportunities.
When you think about over the course of history, every time there is a quote unquote revolution, work does change, right? And this matters to a lot of people. So for example, electricity comes in and so many things that were done manually are no longer done. Printing press, computers in general, and manufacturing technology and things like that. And so it does matter. What I mean by that is it's not to say, hey, artificial intelligence is going to come along and nothing changes. It is going to matter to people that the kinds of jobs are going to change. And I find this very personal for me just because from my background, I was born and raised in inner city Toronto, so to speak. And so the fact that I'm here able to build technology that can impact people's lives is really important.
While AI will expand job opportunities, I think the fear of it ultimately eliminating a significant amount of jobs is real and understood. Andrew Yang ran his campaign on this and the universal basic income that's going to eventually have to happen. I look at things like autonomous vehicles, and it looks like it's going to really expand to freight and trucking first, because these long highway drives will be the easiest to automate versus navigating New York City roads. But from what I've seen, for most of these, there'll still be a human being in that truck. It's going to be driving autonomously, but that person's still going to have a job and still have work to do and still be in that truck gathering data. But eventually, there won't need to be that human. So I think we're fast forwarding quite far into the future, saying eventually this will be job destruction. But I do take the point that in the short term, 10, 20, 30 years, there'll be massive job creation out of AI.
I love that distinction you're making, because that's the whole creative destruction thing. The idea is that, yes, if you zoom out on the chart of unemployment, human history, all these charts are going to be just radically different in like 70 years. There's going to be a smooth line and people are like, well, that's when AI took over the world and everything got better and all these things were amazing. But in the interim, the point you're making, Zib, that I think is so nuanced and insightful, is that there's going to be a lot of fluctuations of chaos in there. I think over time, unemployment will lead to mob violence and all these things that Yang talks about. But I did want to seize on one point about the UBI. With the UBI, that's actually contradicting the notion that ultimately there will be more jobs. I think there will be jobs to the point that UBI will be this thing that we look back on like, oh, we were so skeptical of the future. We had such an un-American outlook on the future that people were building careers like Andrew Yang on top of this idea that we're going to be so desperate that we're going to need the government to provide for us in the information age. I think that's flatly wrong. I think there'll be a transitional period that is going to be hard to manage, but I don't think that UBI is going to be necessary in the future whatsoever.
I do in the distant future. And again, when I say future, I think Andrew Yang is just like 20 years too early. I think that there will be initial job creation. And then once we advance significantly where you don't need that person in the autonomous vehicle sitting there, and it can be one conductor from some centralized location, then we'll need it.
You don't think that there's going to be more productive jobs for them in the future? You really think that's going to be the punctuation mark on human innovation, and there's not going to be another layer to the economy that'll be added in the next 50 years? I just don't believe that.
Yeah, I don't think the timeline is as short as Andrew Yang, but I think it's shorter than you think.
No, I'm rejecting the timeline completely. There's a conflation here. So there's the idea of transitioning over to automation. That's happening. That timeline is independent of what we're talking about in my mind. Talking about unemployment and the fact that there's going to be a group of people who will not be able to participate in the economy, so therefore we need to support them through government welfare. I don't think that's going to happen. I think that that is an alarmist reactionary moment in time where people are overestimating the power of AI in a way that reflects immersion in science fiction over the course of the last like 50, 100 years, where they think, oh my goodness, no one's going to drive the bus. So what are they going to do all day? We got to give them money. I just don't see that. I think that there's going to be new opportunities that are going to come along in the next 50 years that are going to give those people a sense of self. I think it goes against the very nature of humanity to suggest what you're saying.
So you think that the job replacement rate will far exceed the job destruction rate?
Only based on human history.
We haven't seen the likes of what we're experiencing right now in the technological age. Nothing is like the technological revolution we are going to be experiencing and we are experiencing right now. There's nothing like it in history. The rate of acceleration into this technology is going to be much faster than anything we've seen in history. And I know you throw out the timeline. I think that there will be a point in time. For example, there are companies now that are designing autonomous vehicles that can go in and pick strawberries. So those jobs are going away. You only need now one operator. Let's say it's the farmer who's like, okay, I can just operate this machine and do it. Then eventually it's like, well, we don't even need the farmer to have anything to do with this. We can just do it from this remote location and send a bunch of our bots out to produce this.
Right.
Matter of fact, we don't even need a farmer. Let's just buy the farms and then automate and produce this.
That's going back to the agrarian economy. We could not have imagined the industrial economy when we were in the agrarian economy. And comparably, we are not able to imagine the information economy while we're still transitioning out of the industrial economy. To say that there's not going to be another layer of the economy that we can't fathom right now contradicts everything that's happened. And your point about the rate of acceleration doesn't contradict the likelihood of that happening. The rate of acceleration, you could just as easily argue, will accelerate these new opportunities and these new economies. Like the job of a social media influencer, that didn't exist 10 years ago, 15 years ago. This notion that we're suddenly going to get rid of the current economy that we have as a whole and it's not going to grow, I feel is pessimistic.
how do you, as a responsible builder of technology, ensure that people are continuing to get up-leveled and stuff like that and upskilled in kind of a changing economy? And so what I think is that every time there's a wave and a new revolution, so to speak, in terms of technology, and I think computing was one, mobile in many ways was another, and artificial intelligence is going to be another, I think it is going to be net great for humanity. And it's on us as builders and it's on society to continue to make sure that everyone can benefit from that technology and it doesn't get completely skewed.
I want to point out the piece you said, the responsibility of the AI companies and the companies who are disrupting. We had the fortunate opportunity of interviewing a company that had these drones that cleaned the side of buildings. And part of their process and program was to actually retrain these high-rise window washers rather than come in and say, hey, we're going to come in and fire all these people and we'll do it. They actually retrain them to use their technology. So now I can go and clean twice as many buildings. So that concept of owning the responsibility and saying, hey, we're going to bring this new technology to make the world better, to make your life better and safer, but also we're going to retrain these existing folks and create new jobs. But again, that's in the short term. They're going to retrain them, but I do see a world eventually where it's one central hub being controlled by one individual. Now I can control 15 drones cleaning sides of buildings.
Yeah, it'll be like Mark Zuckerberg the 17th. This is not happening very soon, Zibby. Philosophically, if it's 1,000 years in the future, the whole concept of an economy will disintegrate. There's so many contexts or containers that you're assuming will be in place by the time AGI takes over.
I do want to point one thing out, though. We've learned our lesson on letting these companies self-police. There will be responsible companies and founders like Dion, and this was the inspiration for this show, to go out and talk to these founders who are thinking about the future differently and injecting this moral responsibility into what their technology is going to do to our society. And so I think that that's great, but we still can't allow people to self-regulate. There has to be these governing bodies. We will eventually need the UN for AI. Like, we have the folks who go in and look at people's nuclear stocks. How many nuclear weapons do you have? Mm-hmm. We're going to need that for AI, especially. And there are a few NGOs, which I'll get into, that are working to do this.
The first neural network, or perceptron, so to speak, was invented, I believe, in the 80s. And so this has all been around. The other quote I like to think about is, people tend to overestimate what you can achieve in a year and underestimate what you can achieve in a lifetime. And that is the truth about any novel breakthrough algorithm. There's so much we can do that'll eventually become the iRobots or the robots of the future. We're definitely not there yet, but we are making a lot of progress. I honestly think NLU, natural language understanding, natural language processing, is on a very similar curve just 5 or 10 years later than computer vision was 5 or 10 years ago, which eventually led to the self-driving cars and all of this stuff that's going to be trillion-dollar industries. I think we're going to see that now, but just playing out slightly later.
So he references neural networks. I had to do a little bit of research on this, and it might not be something that a lot of listeners know, but the idea of neural networks is that it copies the biological neural networks of an animal. So neural networks, in terms of AI, they'll take inputs and then you get results, and then the machine will learn from these inputs and then putting out results. So that's a high level layman's understanding of this neural network.
That is interesting. The thing I want to jump on from what Dion said, he touches on a theme we discussed earlier, which is there's these waves of technology. One of the ideas that we got to in our interview that was really fascinating was this notion that technological innovation has no innate meaning until you ascribe a value proposition to it. Meaning that the satellites that make GPS possible were not available for everyday citizens. They were only available to the military. And then Clinton changed that, and suddenly that technology enabled GPS. The innovation of those satellites was not inherently valuable until Google Maps. And for someone like Dion, that's incredibly dispiriting, because each one of these incremental advancements on AI is profound. And you can start to look at the trend line and be like, well, if we hit this milestone, that means we're going to be there in 5 years. But no one can really appreciate that until it's wrapped up, packaged, and there's a jingle on a commercial and it says, hey, this is meaningful? Why can't we appreciate all these advancements as they're happening?
It's hard to do it unless you're in it and you understand the thousands and thousands of steps it takes to get to that next level.
Yeah.
I used to have to print out directions from MapQuest. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember MapQuest, but that's before Google Maps existed. That's how you got directions and got around. That was a huge advancement from pulling out a map you bought at a gas station and trying to find where you're going. You print out your MapQuest instructions and you go to the place. And then we have Google Maps now. And people get mad. It's like, where's my street view?
1,000%. And then it's not only that. It's also, think of all the technology that was built on top of Google Maps. Let's use that loosely as GPS technology exclusively. Uber, Uber Eats, DoorDash. There's no way we could have envisioned Uber really in its current incarnation 50 years ago. There's just no way. And the idea of an Uber driver and a Postmates driver and an Instacart driver, we don't have like elevator operators anymore, but we do have Dashers, and there's no way you could have said that Dashers would exist 50 years ago. There's too many layers of technology to imagine.
Yeah, and it plays into your argument of the amount of jobs that it created, and that GPS technology created these massive logistics companies. So you are right, again. But then I'm going to go back to my fictitious timeline, because this section of your interview with Dion really pulled up a few things for me, because he's talking about the potential of AI and the future of AI. And I saw this clip when it came out. It was at the World Artificial Intelligence Conference. It was Jack Ma and Elon Musk, who are kind of going back and forth on what the future of AI looks like. And so Elon Musk goes into this. Well, first you had IBM Watson that was able to win against human chess champions. And then first it was a slow roll, then it could just completely obliterate human chess champions. And then you had AlphaGo, Alphabet's Go player, computer Go player. And that started beating humans. And then you have AlphaZero. No human can beat AlphaZero, basically. So Elon Musk sees this scarier future of these AI taking over. And Jack Ma's argument to this was basically, well, there's this thing called smarts. We created robots. Robots aren't going to be able to create a human being.
Using statistics to solve problems ends up eliminating bias from the problems over time. And so in so many ways, artificial intelligence can be trained. Obviously, if you have biased data, it can lead to bias. But I think in the long run, it wins out and helps us to uncover and eliminate our biases, because we can audit these systems better than we can audit the human brain. And so I truly think this can actually be a way of net long term eliminating bias from decision making, or at least minimizing it.
So I'm very happy that Dion's being thoughtful about bias in AI, since he is leading an AI company. And I hope all founders and folks working in AI are having this thought in the back of their mind. I read a really good article, and it was more related to recidivism and determining jail time using algorithms and software. It was on the World Economic Forum by Vyacheslav Polinsky. And he basically goes through four pillars for designing fairness in AI: representation, protection, stewardship, authenticity. And so representation is just making sure in your data set that you have underrepresented groups. You have a diverse data set that isn't going to skew the output from what you're doing with AI and machine learning. Protection, that's making sure that you are thinking about the impact of this technology on underrepresented and vulnerable groups. Stewardship, making sure that you have either an external partner or internal partners within the company who are going to be bringing up these issues and representing these groups who might not be able to speak for themselves, but will be affected by your technology. And some groups that do this are Privacy International, ProPublica. And then authenticity, and this goes into deep fakes and the ability to use your technology to fake a human. And you talk about Turing tests, Theo, and some of these other things, but these technologies can obviously be used for nefarious purposes.
That's really interesting. What I want to highlight specifically about Dion and his story that has been a topic of conversation with us here at TechLash is his company doesn't actually deal with bias in any way, right? Forethought is an enterprise software company that develops artificial intelligence so that people can perform their jobs better. But Dion happens to be from an underrepresented group. originally, when we first interviewed Dion, there was a conversation that was largely about his product and AI and the industry. And then we touched on unconscious bias in AI. But what's interesting is over the course of 2020, everyone became a lot more conscious, especially with the tragic death of George Floyd. And Dion had to dig into his own feelings about what it means to be a founder of color.
When we first got our term sheet was like 2 or 3 days after George Floyd died. And I don't even know how to process that. I'm like, this is in so many ways a frustrating, crazy time. Like, I was just not okay in so many ways. And at the same time, I'm supposed to be excited because I'm here trying to build this company. But it's like, I have something to say. You know what I mean? I'm non-confrontational. I don't know if I'm a fighter. And so it ended up becoming an epiphany moment for me when I realized that I was like, wait, I'm not a fighter. I'm a builder. And being a builder can be the way that I make an impact on the world by being authentically me. I'm just going to share my story. I'm going to share who I am as a Black individual, as a technical entrepreneur. These are all aspects about me.
It was interesting as we got through the interview, we were talking about identifiers and how we think about ourselves and how we move through the world. And he's from Canada. He's not from the United States. His experience as a founder of color is very specific. And it's not a thing in an immediate sense. And then as he describes in the clip, he realizes it is a thing in a larger sense. It really sounds like he had an awakening.
Yeah, I think a lot of the country had an awakening after that video was distributed widely. And I think a lot of the world had an awakening. I had friends from across the pond in England reach out to me after the George Floyd video came out. It was a difficult time, and I relate to Dion in the sense that I'm no good at going out there and protesting in the streets, but what are things that can be authentic to me? And that's fine. There's people who do that, and God bless them. That's an amazing thing that they can go out and let their voices be heard. But what can I do that's authentic to me? How can I make an impact and change these underlying issues? Because as Larry Wilmore eloquently put it in his piece on George Floyd, which you sent me, Theo, there's this underlying tension and white supremacy in this country. And that doesn't mean Ku Klux Klan white supremacy. This is just this underlying thing that is really restricting people of color in America that we really need to try and break through. And so what can we do to help that? And that is things like going out and hiring people who look like me. That is being a role model to people who look like Dion or who look like myself. That is being a leader in what you do, doing what you do well, but also being a role model to others to change this industry, which is fairly homogenous.
We're probably one of the too few enterprise tech companies founded by a Black person. The fact that that number, that it's atypical, so to speak, does not need to be the case. So even just by being me, being exactly who I am and building this company, I can then go and turn an N of one or an N of two into N's of 10, because then you get other young entrepreneurs, maybe it's a Black kid growing up in the inner city Toronto or wherever it is, saying, hey, oh, okay, when I think about tech icons, most people in the past have thought about Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, right? And they all come from a typical background, look a certain way. And it's like, oh no, but like, there's also Dion, there's also this other person, and they look just like me. And so I think there's power in that, again, in just being unapologetic about that, whether or not we're not building a social justice company per se, but we can, in so many ways, be a force for good in society.
It's true. You can't be what you can't see. The fact is that the industry is so disproportionately homogenous relative to a lot of other industries that it feels unwelcoming to the majority of people. That is unsustainable. That is going to change, not just because of the demographic shift that's going to occur, the 2042 shift where we have a minority majority country, but there are a lot of efforts being made to accelerate that change, to create more diversity in tech, because the technology that's being built is so powerful that to have unconscious bias, not just in AI, but in software design, is something we can't afford.
I completely agree. And as I mentioned, there are things that founders of color can do, underrepresented founders going out and doing the hard work to hire people of color outside of the network, because the network is so homogenous, it is going to take extra effort. Now, I will say something that has been controversial, and it's a reality. And I think these two things can exist at the same time. They're often battled, but there is a lack of diversity in talent pools. And a lot of people cringe at that, or they reject that notion. If you just look at the data and statistics in STEM, where a lot of these jobs come from, there's massive underrepresentation in STEM. So I think to solve this problem, it is going to be more than just folks like myself, folks like Dion, going out and hiring more people of color. It is going to take changes in our education system. It is going to take changes in how we treat certain school districts, gerrymandering and redlining. There's a more massive undertaking here that we also have to be honest about. And we're doing a disservice if we don't speak about that piece as well. That's our show for today. If you enjoyed it, please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends. That would really help us out. If you have any questions or feedback, email us at mailbag@hitstartmedia.com. For Theo Miller, I'm Zibby Nwaka. Have a great week.